Thank you very much. I apologize that I'm unable to speak in French. I hope my English is not too difficult to understand. I'm very grateful to Rachel Vaughan, who has translated the slides that I will be using into French. And I will try to speak not too fast. And also, there will be opportunities for question and discussion after my talk. So, as you have heard, my background is as a clinician working in neonatology in the care of the newborn. And I will going to be talking about how the application of some of the principles, which we heard very helpfully from Dr. Jaeger, about our different understandings of what it means to be human, how does this actually engage in the real world of bioethics and the many challenging questions which are facing us at the beginning and at the end of life? So I worked for many years in a big intensive care unit in central London. We care for very sick newborn babies who require intensive care. And many of them are extremely small. Of a normal 40-week pregnancy, gestation, we care for many babies at the limits of viability at 24 weeks, 23 weeks, 22 weeks. The smallest baby I cared for who survived was 21 weeks and 6 days. A baby weighing 500 grams and literally fitting in my hand. And this kind of medicine is a very technological, sophisticated kind of medicine. We use a great deal of modern scientific and technological techniques. And one of the questions it raises is how do we think about a being like this on the edge of life? There are really two quite different understandings. One understanding is that this being is not really a person the same as the rest of us. It is some kind of potential, a being of potential for the future, but cannot be regarded as completely the same as us. And the other view is, no, this is a person who is just the same as every other human person, weak and fragile, but still of unique value and significance. And it is interesting that this argument about the value of the newborn is a very ancient argument. It is an argument that has continued for more than 2,000 years, and you can trace it to the beginning of the Christian era, where in the Greco-Roman world, the killing of unwanted babies was very common, infanticide, and a baby was seen as a purely potential being. But the early Christians took a very different position. They said, no, every baby is special, every baby is unique, and they deliberately went out to rescue abandoned babies and to care for them. And they were known as people who cared for even the weakest and the most unwanted and those with disabilities because of their belief in the specialness of human life. I remember many years ago as a junior doctor, when I first read those words, it was like a light bulb went in my head, and I said, of course, this is the way, as Christian people, we have to respond. It is not just with philosophical arguments about the value of life, but we must demonstrate by our actions, by practical compassion and caring. That is actually a picture of my hand, and one of the babies on the baby unit, just to give an idea of the scale. As technology advances, it leads to many questions and challenges. So this is a MRI scan of a very preterm baby showing bleeding in the center of the brain. And as technology advances, we are able to detect brain damage at a very early stage while a baby is still undergoing intensive care. But then the question is, how do we respond with this information? Is it right to switch off the life support machinery? And how do we make these decisions? And I, as a clinician, have had to wrestle with many of these kind of very, very challenging, difficult questions. And as a Christian believer, to ask, how can I match and build a bridge between a Christian understanding of human life being made in God's image and this technology, the challenges of modern technology? So there are no easy answers. I have no easy answers. If you're interested in some of these topics, I have written a book which is translated into French, Matters of Life and Death, and which deals with some of these issues in greater detail and tries to see how Christian principles can apply in practice. So I would recommend that as a further reading. And one of the great challenges of the modern world is the way that often it seems that contradictory activities are going on at the same time, activities which go in opposite directions. So in the neonatal unit, we try to value every life, however small, however precious, and we invest a lot of resources in caring for these babies. The total cost in the UK for this kind of care is now about 2,000 euros per baby per day. So the total cost to ensure that one severely premature baby survives can easily be 100,000 euros, all paid for by the state. And yet, in the same hospital, just one floor away, is the fetal medicine unit. And here we see many pregnant women from a wide area of London and in southeast England. And the mothers are referred when an abnormality of the fetus is detected. They receive many sophisticated tests, including ultrasound. This is amniocentesis and genetic, prenatal genetic screening and diagnosis. And very frequently, this pattern is detected. Here we have a baby with trisomy 21, or Down syndrome. You can see here the additional chromosome, and we know that when this is detected before birth, that this child will be affected in some way by Down syndrome. We cannot predict how severe the condition will be, but in the UK, every time this is detected, the mother will be given the option of an abortion to destroy the fetus. And in the UK at present, over 90% of mothers will choose to have an abortion if Down syndrome is detected. And because of the way that the law will operate in the UK, it is legal for an abortion to be carried out at any stage of the pregnancy if there is a significant risk of disability, or the fetus will in some way be affected. And so in my own hospital in central London, late abortions, or the correct term is feticide, are carried out regularly at 26 weeks, 28 weeks, 30 weeks, 32 weeks, even 36 weeks. And many times I have been called from working in the intensive care unit with a neonate to go one floor to the fetal medicine unit to ask to speak to a mother who is considering whether or not to have an abortion. And frequently a pediatrician is involved in discussing with the mother. And the baby in her womb is much bigger and stronger and has more vitality than the babies we are struggling to save in one floor down. And then you say, how is it possible in one hospital for these different contradictory attitudes? And I think this is because we live in what philosophers call a pluralistic society, a society where there are many different competing understandings about what it means to be human, of the value of life. And when you have public institutions like the National Health Service in the UK, it is trying to cope with all these competing understandings, and it creates many contradictory activities and certainly causes a great deal of distress often for the staff working in these situations. So at the same time as we value the newborn babies, we have a whole program to try and identify the fetus who is abnormal in order to have the option of abortion. And the situation is about to become much more complex as the technology advances. The phenomenon is called non-invasive prenatal diagnosis. It uses a simple blood test in a pregnant woman, and it isolates the free fetal DNA from the circulating bloodstream. And this is a very powerful new technology, which is becoming now, it is about to become part of the routine screening for pregnant women. And it is actually possible to obtain the entire genome of a fetus from taking a single blood test from the mother. So imagine maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, you are pregnant, or your wife, or your daughter, and everyone is very happy, and you go to see the doctor and they say, we'd just like to do a simple blood test to check everything is all right. And then you go back after 2 weeks and they say, well, you're having a little girl, congratulations. But I'm sorry to say that she has a 60% chance of breast or ovarian cancer developing before the age of 50. She has an increased risk of type 2 diabetes and also early onset Alzheimer's disease. Now, do you think it would be responsible for you to bring this child into the world? Do you feel that this is a morally good act for you? And you can just see the dilemmas that ordinary people will be faced with. How do you use all this information? How, as you predict the future, how can, as parents, we act in a wise way? So the technology is able to give us information which before only God himself could know. It is like godlike information. But when you have godlike information, you also have godlike responsibility. How do we act responsibly with this godlike information? I believe, from a Christian point of view, there is an argument to say, no, we don't want that information. It is actually not helpful to know all this genetic information before the baby is born. I think the way that God has made us is that when we are a parent and we first meet our newborn baby, the baby is like a stranger. And you fall in love with this stranger because they're just so lovely. It's a lovely little baby and you just fall in love with them. And then over the next 18 years, you discover all the unpleasant genetic characteristics, all the revolting and bad things about your child. But by then it is too late because you have fallen in love with them. What genetic technology does is it reverses what prenatal screening does. We learn a great deal about our child before we have met them. And in my view, that is not the way it was meant to be. We're meant to meet our children first, and then we discover about them. Of course, there are rare situations where discovering information about the fetus can actually help us in treatment. And in that situation, then yes, I think it is valuable. But if it is simply the only option is abortion, then I think it's better to say no, I don't want to know that information. So, reproductive technology is changing the way we think about parenthood, what it means to be a parent. And it has made the whole process much more mechanical. This is the way that you make a baby in the 21st century. When I was a medical student, which was a very long time ago, the only way you made a baby was a man and a woman had sexual intercourse. But now it's very different. Now you just have a source of eggs, you have a source of sperm, you have a uterus, a womb, and you have someone to care for the baby. And there is no reason why any of these four variables should be connected. And so you can have embryo donation, surrogate parents. You can even go onto the internet and create a baby by Google. There have been cases, people have done this. You select a sperm donor, you select an egg donor, you select a surrogate mother, you pay, you give your credit card details, and you can create a child of your own dreams. And, of course, this leads to many challenging and difficult things. This is Elton John and his male partner who have used surrogate mothers to create children using their own sperm. And caring for their children. In the UK, we had this bizarre case where a daughter was dying with cancer, and she arranged for her eggs to be harvested, and she asked her mother to carry a child that was created with her eggs. So at the same time, The woman was both the grandmother and the mother of the baby that she is carrying. And this went to the courts, but the judge said, yes, this is okay, as provided everybody gives consent. We are free to use the technology. And this is a very strange picture, but this is a biological female who chose to transition to a male and took male hormones in order to become a male, but she retained a womb, a uterus, and she then decided to become pregnant. So, and she calls herself a pregnant father. So these are some of the confusions. And, you know, how do we respond to these kind of things? You know, I think the first thing we must understand is the pain that lies behind these issues. It seems to me that really almost every moral dilemma in medicine starts with human pain. It starts with people who struggle and bleed and suffer. And behind these kind of strange technological feats, there is often deep human anguish and sadness and tragedy and suffering. And I think our responsibility as Christians is not first to say, oh, how disgusting, how horrible. It is instead to say, we must understand and empathize with the pain that drives people to these situations. An American lawyer has argued that in the future, the proper way to have a baby will be with reproductive technology. You know, that old idea of sex, you know, that's so 20th century. You know, we have moved on beyond this kind of random lottery. So he says, within the next 20 to 40 years, it is likely that the majority of babies in developed countries will be conceived in IVF clinics and receive whole genome sequencing as embryos before being selected for transfer to the womb. Now that seems to me a bit of an overstatement, but you can see the idea that you could create with reproductive technology, you could perhaps create 50 or 100 embryos, all of them genetically different, and then you screen them all. You use sophisticated artificial intelligence and genetics to select the best embryo that will have the best characteristics. And the UK is becoming an area which is really keen to advance this kind of technology to modify human embryos. And it's interesting to think, what are the forces behind this kind of activity? And it seems to me you can identify at least three of the forces. Consumerism, which says, I want to have a baby. I want to have it. This. I don't want to have a child with disabilities. And then there is moral relativism that says, well, why not? What's wrong with it? If, as long as we properly monitor the procedures, as long as the sperm are properly tested to make sure there isn't HIV infection, what's wrong? How can we say no? And then technology says, we can satisfy your desires. Whatever it is, we will satisfy your desires, but it will cost you. And of course, the cost is not just an economic cost, it is also a human cost that so often technology brings. So these different forces of consumerism, of relativism, and of technology are all combining into a very powerful force. And I think particularly in healthcare, these three forces are very strong. And if you are going into the world of healthcare in the future, I guarantee that these forces will affect the practice of healthcare for the future. And one of the things we need to think deeply about is technology. Technology is not a simple, superficial force. It has a very profound, complex foundation. And the Canadian philosopher George Grant said that it is in the very word techne logos. Techne, which means making, and logos, which means knowing, that technology is the interpenetration of making and knowing, and it is all about mastery of nature. It is humans getting control of nature. And for hundreds of years, we have used technology to control the natural world, to master nature and make it according to our desires. But what has recently happened is that technology is now being used on human nature. So it's not just the natural world. Now we will master and control our very own humanity. We will use technology to make humans what we wish. And of course, this is not all bad. There are many, many positive things which come with the application of technology. And in my own field of medicine, technology has made a profound difference to the survival of vulnerable human beings. So there are very many good and positive aspects of technology, but it always carries with it power structures. And in particular, the danger is the manipulation and the instrumentalization. It is to take a human and turn it into an instrument, to turn it into a tool. And it's always the vulnerable, it is the weak, who are subject. And C.S. Lewis, the well-known English writer, writing at the end of the Second World War, he wrote these words. He said, "The power of man over nature turns out to be power exerted by some men over other men." So we must always ask the power question. Who is being abused? Who is being dominated? Who is being instrumentalized? So these are the issues at the beginning of life. Just briefly, of course, also issues at the end of life. We have had many cases in the UK, tragic cases of people who wished to commit suicide because they felt their life was of no value. This was a very promising young rugby player. He played for the England junior team, and then he was involved in a serious accident, fracture of the cervical spine, paralyzed from the shoulders downwards, and he became deeply depressed. He felt that his life was not worth living. His parents tried to support him and encourage him, but then he said to them, "If you really love me, you will help me to kill myself." And in the end, they agreed, and they took him to the clinic, in the Dignitas clinic in Switzerland. And he was killed with lethal drugs. And the newspapers in the UK, nearly all of them said, what loving parents, that they really put the interest of their child first. They were not selfish. And why did he have to travel to Switzerland? Why could he not have this treatment, quotes, in the UK? And many other tragic stories. This was a man with locked-in syndrome, where he is conscious and alert, but he is locked in his body. And he said, "If I could move my arms, I would kill myself. But because I cannot move my arms, it is against my human rights, and a doctor must be allowed to kill me with an injection." And this case went all the way to the Supreme Court in the UK, but eventually it was refused. But similar cases, tragic cases, are constantly coming. We have another case at the moment which has gone to the appeal court in a similar case. Of course, we know in many countries, such as in Holland, various forms of medical killing are now becoming more common, and the statistics are showing a steady rise in numbers and an extension of the different types of patients who are being killed. And now it seems to be spreading across the US. California is the latest state, and certainly what we know in England is what happens in California this year. It's going to happen in the UK next year, so it's pretty ominous that California is now passed an assisted suicide law. And Canada has also passed a law and is now... euthanasia has become embedded in the health system in Canada. In fact, it's now become almost impossible for hospitals to refuse to participate in euthanasia by lethal injection. And all this has just happened in 18 months. I think one of the issues behind all this is a fear about dementia. For many people, dementia is now the most feared way to die. Dementia has replaced cancer as the thing that is most feared. And I have noticed for many Christians that is the case. In fact, I think particularly for Protestant Christians, because we put such a stress on the importance of faith, the importance of what is happening in my mind and my beliefs. What happens when my mind is going, when I'm no longer sure what I believe? What happens if I lose my faith? Is the heart of my Christian life, is it lost? What a terrible prospect that my whole salvation might be lost because I lose my mind. And the projections are quite frightening because these are projections in the UK, because dementia is an age-related illness. The more elderly people there are in the community, the higher the incidence of dementia. But it's not just with dementia. There is the whole question, what does it mean to die well? You know, if you ask people how they wish to die, the commonest answer you get, and this includes Christian people, is I want to die in my bed at night. I don't want to know anything about it. I don't want to have any warning. I don't want to have any preparation. I just want to go without knowing anything. Wouldn't it be wonderful? What a wonderful way to die. Well, the truth is, not many people die like that. In reality, many, many people die like one of these two things. Either on the left is cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is failed with cardiac massage and ventilation and electric shocks. On the right is an intensive care unit surrounded by machinery, abandoned, medicalized. And this way of dying, we need to ask the question, what does it mean as a Christian to die well? It's interesting that actually I don't believe sudden death, sudden unexpected death, is a good way to die. My father died like that, and it really still hurts me years later that I was never able to have a last conversation with him. I was never able to say how much I loved him. I was never able to hear what his last words to me would be, and to share that experience with him. And you know, for Christians in the previous era, they used to specifically pray against sudden death. Sudden death was seen as a terrible way to die. And so it's interesting how, because of our modern secular thinking, we have adopted this idea that just to go out like a light is a great way. So we have some people desperately wanting to die, to kill themselves. And then we have other people desperately wanting to keep alive for as long as possible and using technology to extend life. And there are some people around thinking it may be possible to extend life not just to 120, maybe 150, maybe even almost infinite life. How do we think about this from a Christian point of view? Is this a good thing that we should try to extend life as much as possible? It's interesting that in the Genesis text, we heard Dr. Yeager talking about those early, very profound statements. That, do you remember this in Genesis chapter 3, after the fall, Adam and Eve are actually driven out of the garden, and God places an angel and a flashing sword to prevent the fallen human beings getting back into the garden. And it's clear in the narrative why that is. And the reason is, it is to stop the fallen people eating the fruit of the tree of life and living forever. And in fact, in the biblical narrative, human life is curtailed because of the fall, because of human evil. And you know, it is quite true that the wonderful thing about death, it's a strange thing to say, but it's true, the wonderful thing about death is it ends the evil of a dictator. However evil Stalin is, or Mugabe, or Mao Zedong, whatever terrible things they do, that will come to an end because they will die. So death limits human evil. And I think this teaches us something very profound. To live forever in a fallen state is not a blessing. It's a curse. And in fact, the hope for mankind is not ever extending human life. The hope for mankind is through death and resurrection, to be recreated in the image of the Lord Jesus, as the Apostle Paul, Apostle John says, when we see him, Jesus, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Our new bodies will be recreated like the risen Lord Jesus. So how do we think about these issues? What is a person? In secular thinking, a person is often related to the concept of autonomy. And this is Peter Singer, a well-known philosopher, who argues a person is a being who has the capacity for self-awareness and making choices, exercising preferences about continuing life. So personhood, to be a person, is about choice. And so Peter Singer then says, a newborn baby is not a person. They are human, but they are a non-person. But he also says, a chimpanzee, an adult chimpanzee, is a person. Because a chimpanzee is capable of making choices. And so he would say that a chimpanzee is a non-human person. And of course, a human with dementia or brain injury also is not a person, because they have lost the autonomy. So the human race is divided into those who are persons, the full elite, and then the other sort of humans, fetuses, mental illness, brain injury, dementia. Non-persons. So it's in this thinking, it's autonomy, my right to choose, which gives personhood its value, its meaning and value. And of course, along with that is the idea that within my own personhood, I have all the resources to become a whole person, to become fully integrated. I must find my own truth and tell my own story. So, how do these things change our understanding of being human? And now I come to some Christian responses and thoughts. I think what we've called to do is to build a bridge between, on the one hand, this complex, challenging, difficult world of biomedical technology, and on the other hand, an authentic biblical Christian understanding of being human. And I think this analogy of a bridge is quite helpful. It's something that I learnt as a younger person from John Stott, who was a senior church leader and teacher. And he said, we have to have a bridge which is rooted on the one hand in the world, the Bible and the Christian faith, but which manages to communicate at the same time and make contact with across this great gulf into the modern secular world. And he talked about the failed bridges. There's one bridge which is rooted in the Christian world, but it just goes up into heaven. It's lost contact with the modern world. And Stott said that's a heresy. And he said he called it the fundamentalist heresy. And then there is the opposite kind of heresy, and that is a bridge which is rooted in the modern world, but has lost contact with the authentic biblical shore. And that is the liberal heresy. But if we are going to be faithful to Christ, we have to be rooted on both sides of the bridge. And how do we know that it's possible to build the bridge? There are many cynics who would say it's impossible. You cannot connect this world of the ancient Near Eastern rural world with the modern world of biomedical technology. It's ridiculous. But you know, theologically, we can say, I know, as I stand here, that it's possible to build the bridge. And that is because of Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ is alive and is real, someone who is fully human and at the same time fully divine, one person, then I know that it's possible to build the bridge. In fact, theologically, Jesus Christ is the bridge. He is the one who is rooted on both sides. And therefore, we, as we bind ourselves to Christ, as we are obedient to Christ, we too can build the bridge. So Christian ethics, the way we treat one another, comes from Christian anthropology, the way we're made. And so if we just look briefly at some teaching about how we are made, which will help us in how we should treat one another. And Dr. Yeager has already talked about the centrality of the imago Dei, that as human beings we are created in God's image. And notice that in the original Hebrew, it is in the plural text, let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness. And when we read this with Christian eyes, we see the Trinity. Let us, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, make human beings in our image, as Trinitarian image. So, in Christian thinking, human beings are not self-explanatory. They do not explain themselves. This is part of the limitation of science. Science can only see explanation of humanity within its own methodology. It seeks to use the methodology to understand what it means to be human. But human beings do not explain themselves. Why? Because we are images. We are reflections. And so our meaning comes from outside ourselves. Our meaning is not in ourselves. Our meaning is outside. And here is an analogy. Suppose that some alien being somewhere in the galaxy is receiving through their antennae a strange distorted image. And you can imagine these alien intelligences trying to understand the meaning of this image. And they try to analyze every single pixel. They look at the frequency absorption spectra. They look at the spatial arrangements and the topology. They will never understand this image unless they understand that it's a map. It's actually the London Underground map. And so this image is actually a reflection of something completely different. These metallic beings which go trundling through the planet of a particular planet of a particular time. So here we have two quite different things. We have an abstract image with colors and lines. We have physical coaches made out of metal. These two images have a hidden connection. One is a reflection of the other. Now, that's just an analogy, but it seems to me that the God of the universe chose to take a pathetic carbon-based organism and use that organism as a map, as a reflection of his own character and being. And so you will never understand that organism unless you understand that we are reflections, we are maps. And therefore, human beings do not explain themselves. The structure of our humanity, the values, the purposes of our lives only make sense because we are reflect another reality. And we see that very clearly in this verse in Genesis chapter 9. Very well known. It is said this is one of the earliest legal statutes in the entire world literature. And it says, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? For in the image of God has God made man. So in this verse, the lex talionis, that ancient human taboo against the shedding of blood, is linked with this mysterious image of God. It's because of the Imago Dei that the destruction of human blood is in some sense an insult to God himself. It is to spit in the face of the Creator to destroy his image. So human beings are wonderful beings, but also, and again we come to our anthropology, human beings are created out of dust. In the literal Hebrew, Adam, the name for human, is derived from Adama, which is the ground. So it's in our very name is that we are made out of the ground, the dust. And the same is true in English. In English, the word human is derived from humus. Not the nice stuff that you put on pita bread, but the soil, the compost heap. That is in our name, human. And is that true in French as well? Is that connection there? It'd be interesting to know. So We are made out of the same stuff as everything else, and that means that we share the limitations of the physical universe, and we are designed to be physical and embodied, to be dependent, to be frail, and to be vulnerable. Now, please notice that this is creation. This is not the fall. This is actually design. God chose to make us like this. He chose to make us so that we are utterly and totally dependent. You came into this world utterly dependent on the love of other people. In fact, you would not be sitting there unless somebody fed you. Somebody washed your bottom. Somebody cared for you. Otherwise, you would have died. And then we go through a phase of our life when other people depend on us. My wife and I, we have three boys. They have now left home. They are adults. And you think, at last, we've gone. And then the phone rings. Dad, 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 can you put £1,000 in my account? What's £1,000? So this period when other people depend on us goes on for a very long time. But, you know, at the end of life, most of us will become dependent again on others, and others will care for us. And I remember my mother. My mother was a lovely Christian lady of great faith and activity, but she became affected by severe dementia. And at the end of her life, she was utterly trapped in a body. She could do nothing for herself. And she required 24-hour nursing care. And I was visiting her, and somebody put a yogurt pot and a teaspoon in my hand. And I was saying, open your mouth, open your mouth. Here it comes, open your mouth, here it comes. And then I suddenly remembered, this is exactly what she used to do for me. And I could remember how she used to feed me. And now the tables were turned. But I also remember very clearly at that moment, I had a thought. I was learning that this was the way it was meant to be. I was learning what it means to be a son. And she was learning what it means to be a mother. Because dependence is part of the story. Dependence is part of the narrative. So dependence is not an alien, subhuman, undignified condition. It's part of the narrative. It's part of the plan God has given to us. It's part of our humanity. So as we think about this question, what does it mean to be a person? I think that if we simply adopt a materialism or a physicalism, we miss out on a whole dimension. And this is a limitation of modern neuroscience and of the physicalist sciences, because there is another foundational category of reality, and it's not, I don't think it's helpful to think about it as the mind or as consciousness. I think it's best to think about it as the person, the personal. A person is constituted by their relations. Their being is derived from the movement of communion, from the freedom of giving oneself to another. So this is where the Christian understanding of the Trinity comes in. In the Trinity, there are three persons who are constantly giving themselves to one another. And it's a profound and mysterious thought, but the person of the Father depends on the existence of the Son. The Father cannot be Father unless the Son exists. The Son cannot be Son unless the Father exists. The persons of the Trinity are constituted by their relations. And if that is in the nature of the Godhead, it is also in the nature of Homo sapiens. We too are persons made in God's image. And we, in some sense, participate in the divine life of the Trinity. So, whereas Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, he puts the whole essence of humanity in conscious awareness. And of course, that's been profoundly influential. I think a Christian understanding is amor ego sum. You love me. I am loved. Therefore, I am. It is actually our being is constituted in our relations and in this Trinitarian understanding. And I think this gives us some kind of response to this terrible fear of dementia. Because my personhood, who I am, is actually held in the being of God himself. Whatever happens in the chance events, the contingencies of life, whatever happens to my brain and my conscious experience, my personhood, who I actually am, is secure in the eternal knowledge and the covenant love of God himself. So whereas in the secular understanding of personhood, there is a deep fragility. At any time it can be broken, it can be lost, it can be damaged. In the Christian understanding of personhood, there is a profound resilience. Because my personhood is held in the personhood of God himself, who cannot change. I'm held secure. I will always be me. I am held secure in the unchangeable reality of God and his purposes. But you know, the most wonderful and strange thing which the Christian faith teaches us is that God himself enters into the human condition. So he doesn't just create this vulnerable, fragile, wonderful being and say, well, good luck, you know, all the best with that. You know, it's going to be difficult, but, you know, all the best. No, he actually enters into the human experience. He takes on flesh, and he makes himself dependent. Have you thought about this? The baby Jesus can do nothing for himself. He is utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. The God himself has made himself vulnerable and fragile. And yet the Christian faith teaches us that at that very moment of fragility, he is upholding the entire universe by the word of his power. So his divine dignity and his status is not affected by dependence. And we need to remember this because, my sisters and brothers, at some stage you will find yourself probably in a hospital ward and you need to be fed and you need to be washed and you need to have your bottom wiped. But just remember that your divine dignity and status as a beloved princess or prince is in no way touched by dependence, because God himself has been before us. And so our humanity is not a barrier which comes between us and God. It is the very means by which God reveals himself. He reveals himself in weakness, in frailty, and in dependence. So I come back to this photograph, and I think, I've often stared at this photograph, and I've thought to myself, where is God in this photograph? Do I think that God is like this massive hand and I'm like this little hand who is hanging on? Well, yes, very often that is how it feels to me. I am this tiny hand and I am desperately hoping and praying that this big hand will uphold me. But you know, wonderfully, you can spin the picture round, and the God of the universe chooses to make himself the little hand. He chooses to become vulnerable and fragile in order to teach us about the dignity of dependence. Dependence is not easy. It's not simple. It's often painful. And yet it seems to me it's the way that God has made our life. And so I think in a secular culture that sees dependence as a great evil, we as Christians have a very profound and paradoxical message which we see in the person of Jesus. So I come to the end. It seems to me we must defend the preciousness and the integrity of every human life. Why? Because this is the form in which God became flesh. This strange thing of humanity has been given special nobility because of Christ. Because Jesus was a baby, all babies are special. Because Jesus was a fetus, all fetuses are special. Because Jesus was a dying person, all dying people are precious. Jesus has entered into the human experience. Dependence and fragility, vulnerability, these are all part of creation design. And rather than fear and oppose these things, we actually, in a strange way, should be prepared to celebrate them. I think we should resist this tendency to master and improve our human nature. So it seems to me to use technology to restore human nature. To oppose disease and disability where possible is appropriate, but to use technology to actually change and master and improve on our own design is to go beyond a step which I think we are called to. So this is sometimes called the distinction between restorative therapy and enhancing therapy. Now, I recognize that's not always a clear-cut distinction. There is a gray zone sometimes. But I think the principle is important. Restorative therapy is, in principle, a fundamental good that we should encourage and develop. Enhancing therapy is to go to another step, which I myself feel in general is wrong. Instead of trying to destroy fetuses with genetic disease, it seems to me it's much better for us to develop practical, compassionate ways of caring and those affected by genetic disorders and looking for restorative therapies where possible. I, some years ago, had very close friends who had this child who had Edwards syndrome. The diagnosis was made before birth. Edwards syndrome is trisomy 18. It's much worse than Down syndrome. It's nearly always lethal. It causes major complications. And when a diagnosis is made before birth, there is strong pressure to have an abortion because the doctors say surely to have an abortion in the case of Edwards syndrome is the loving thing, the right thing to do. But Verity and Alan, her husband, who were very good friends of ours, they wrestled with this, and in the end they said, this baby has been given to us by God, we must love and care for this baby and not destroy it. And so little baby Christopher was born, and he had all the signs of severe Edwards syndrome. He had cardiac malformation, brain malformation. But he didn't die straight away, and they were able to bring him home. And they used to bring him every Sunday to our church in central London, where he became like a little celebrity. Everybody, it's quite a large church in central London, but everybody knew about baby Christopher, and everybody wanted to give him a cuddle. And he used to get passed from arm to arm, and everybody knew her. He was the smallest member of the church. He was only 2.5 kilograms when he was born. And 7 months later, he was still 2.5 kilograms. And eventually, he became weaker and weaker, and he died quite peacefully at home. And there was a memorial service for baby Christopher. And more than 400 people packed the church to remember this tiny little pathetic baby. And one of the Alan Verity's friends said, although Christopher could not grow, he helped other people to grow. And it's true. And I just thought, you know, this is such an illustration of Christian theology in practice. Because from a secular point of view, this life is pointless and futile and has no quality. But mysteriously, Christopher too was a person with all kinds of disabilities. But that person reached out and touched many, many lives and changed lives. So I love this quotation from Joseph Piper, who says, love is a way of saying to a person, it's good that you exist, it's good that you're in the world. The trouble with abortion and euthanasia is it says the opposite. It says it's bad that you exist. It's good for the world if you didn't exist. But Christian love says no. It's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. And that's something we need to learn how to say to each other, how to say to the weak and the disabled and the fragile and the vulnerable and those with dementia. It's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. As we think about death, you know, on the one hand, death is not to be welcomed. Death is an enemy which we fight against. And yet, in God's grace, death can change to be turn into what C.S. Lewis called a severe mercy. It's even a strange kind of healing. And so, as Christian physicians, we fight against death. We try to keep death away, but we recognize that a point may come when we must say, enough is enough. We take our hands away. We allow death to occur. And so we have these two aspects, to fight against death as an enemy, to recognize there is a time to say enough. And the wonderful Christian doctor, Cicely Saunders, in the UK, developed a whole new way of thinking, of caring for dying people, which has now gone around the world, of palliative care. And it came out of her Christian conviction. She said, you matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. Not only will we help you to die well, but we will help you to live before you die. So a way of helping people to see the value even of those who are dying and supporting them in those final days. And out of that movement came this great quote, suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence. We can't explain suffering, but we can be there. We can be the hands of Christ. We can show practical Christian compassion. And in this way, we point to our theology. Human beings made in God's image, made out of dust. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. Je vous ai dit une bêtise, la conférence n'était pas traduite. Vous l'avez normalement... Enfin, en gros, il y a plusieurs solutions. Si vous avez entendu une traduction, ça veut dire que soit en fait vous comprenez l'anglais, soit il faut absolument consulter un psychiatre assez bientôt. Mais par contre, j'ai confondu parce que le temps de questions-réponses qui va avoir lieu maintenant sera traduit, lui. Voilà. Donc... vous allez pouvoir poser vos questions. Je ne sais pas qui de Rachel et de David va faire le français-anglais ou l'anglais-français. Mais en tout cas, si vous voulez poser vos questions, vous pouvez le faire maintenant.
Donc merci. Je voudrais venir sur un point qui, je n'avais jamais pensé à cela, c'est qu'effectivement le fait d'être vulnérable, fragile, dépendant fait partie de la création de l'homme. Mais alors si c'est cela, ça veut dire qu'un bébé doit être ou exprimer quelque chose d'une personne, peut-être plus même qu'une personne adulte. J'avais toujours pensé qu'au final c'est quand même le bébé qui est une personne en devenir et l'adulte c'est la personne dans sa plénitude. Est-ce qu'il y a quelque chose comme ça? Est-ce qu'on peut parler de l'épanouissement? Et est-ce qu'il y a des aspects où le bébé exprimerait peut-être mieux certains aspects de la personne par rapport à l'adulte? So I always thought of, say, a baby kind of a person... So becoming and so, but the plentiful or the person in its fullness of being would be the adult person.
I think there is deep mystery here.
Il y a un grand mystère ici.
What it means to be a person.
Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire être une personne?
A common theological paradox is between the already and the not yet.
Il y a le paradoxe théologique bien connu, classique, le déjà mais le pas encore.
And this is the idea that every human person is on a narrative. There is a narrative arc.
C'est l'idée qu'en fait, on vit tous un récit.
And one way of expressing this is to say that every person is becoming what they already are.
Et on peut dire dans un sens, chaque personne devient ce qu'elle est déjà.
And that is true for the baby.
C'est vrai pour un bébé.
But it's also true for us.
Mais c'est vrai aussi pour un adulte.
Because by God's grace, I am not yet what God has planned for me.
Je ne suis pas encore ce que Dieu voudrait que je sois.
I am still on a journey, and God has many more wonderful things planned for you and for me.
Je suis sur un chemin, je chemine, et Dieu a en prévision pour nous de choses merveilleuses.
What Paul says, things that no eye has seen, that no ear has heard.
Comme Paul a dit, des choses que aucun œil n'a vu, qu'aucune oreille n'a entendu.
C.S. Lewis says, if you could see your neighbor as they will be in the future.
C.S. Lewis a dit, si vous pouviez voir votre prochain comme il sera à l'avenir.
You would either see a being of such glory that you would be tempted to worship them.
Vous verriez un être tellement glorieux que vous seriez tenté de l'adorer.
Or you would see a being of horror and would shrink from them.
Ou vous verriez un être si horrible que vous voudriez vous en éloigner.
So we are all on a journey, and it is only in God's ultimate future that we will become what we were meant to be.
Donc on fait tous partie, on est en route, et ce n'est qu'à l'avenir que l'on sera complètement ce que Dieu voudrait que l'on soit.
So I am further on the journey than the baby.
J'ai fait plus de chemin qu'un bébé.
But we are both the same because we are both on the way.
Mais nous sommes tous en route.
I think this is also an important principle that we must care for people now in the light of what, by God's grace, they will become.
Donc il y a un principe là, on doit prendre soin des gens maintenant à la lumière de ce qu'ils vont devenir par la suite.
So when I looked at my mother, I saw a body that was a wreckage.
Quand j'ai vu ma mère dans ses derniers jours, elle faisait comme un naufrage.
But with the eyes of faith, I tried to see that this was not the end of the story.
Mais avec les yeux de la foi, j'ai vu que c'était pas la fin de l'histoire.
And there was the inner person was somehow still there.
Et que l'être intérieur était toujours là.
So in secular caring, you say, well, we must care for this person now because once they were a great person.
Donc la It pensée is. Plutôt laïque, c'est-à-dire on doit s'occuper de cette personne parce qu'elle était vraiment une personne à part entière.
It's like an exercise in nostalgia.
Une sorte d'exercice de nostalgie.
But in Christian thinking, we say we must care for this person both about the past, but also of what by God's grace.
Mais dans la pensée chrétienne, on s'occupe de cette personne, oui, à la fois à cause de ce qu'elle était, mais aussi parce qu'elle sera autre chose par la grâce de Dieu par la suite.
I'm referring back to the first part of your presentation. There was quite an old movie called Welcome to Gattaca, and what you're saying is that we're about to be able to live it, right?
It's a film called Gattaca.
Excusez-moi, monsieur.
Ah, pardon. Alors, en français, En fait, il y a un film qui s'appelle Bienvenue à Gattaca. Ouais. Je ne sais pas si vous connaissez, mais en gros, l'idée, c'est que les fœtus sont sélectionnés justement sur la base de leur code génétique et qu'en gros, s'ils ne sont pas parfaits, ben, ils sont éliminés, quoi. Et donc, il y a deux catégories de gens, les parfaits et puis ben, les autres.
Yes, it's a very good film.
Oui, c'est un très bon film.
And we sometimes use it for as a starter for ethics discussions.
Et je l'ai utilisé comme une entrée en matière pour des discussions sur l'éthique.
I think there are certainly forces in society that are pushing in that direction.
Il y a certainement des forces au sein de notre société qui nous poussent dans cette direction.
We live in a very interesting time because the forces in the opposite direction are the humanistic forces.
Donc nous vivons une époque intéressante parce qu'il y a d'autres forces un peu humanistes qui vont dans l'autre sens.
And such things as the Declaration of Universal Human Rights.
Par exemple, la Déclaration universelle des droits de l'homme.
Is used to say no, all human beings are important.
On l'utilise pour dire non, tous les êtres humains ont de l'importance.
The interesting thing is that in secular philosophy, it is impossible to find an ultimate ground for the Declaration of Universal Human Rights.
Mais le vrai problème, c'est que dans cette pensée laïque, il est impossible de trouver un fondement solide pour cette déclaration des droits de l'homme.
Because this is a Christian idea.
Parce qu'au fond, c'est une idée chrétienne.
And therefore, secular humanism is really just a Christian heresy.
Donc on peut dire que l'humanisme non chrétien est une sorte d'hérésie chrétienne.
It has the application, but it has lost the metaphysics.
Il y a des applications, mais en perdant toute métaphysique.
But I think this is a very unstable situation.
Mais c'est une situation qui manque de stabilité.
And I wonder how long a Universal Declaration of Human Rights can continue with no metaphysical foundation.
Et je me demande pendant combien de temps la Déclaration des droits de l'homme pourra subsister sans fondement métaphysique.
And so we may be starting to see a movement away from these egalitarian ideals.
Donc, il se peut que nous assistions à un éloignement de cet idéal égalitaire.
And the kind of philosophy of Peter Singer, the autonomy ideas, always lead to a hierarchy. They always lead to distinctions.
Et la philosophie de Peter Singer dont on a parlé, la notion de l'autonomie, mène toujours à une sorte d'hierarchie de valeurs.
So I think we live in a very unstable times.
Donc nous vivons une époque très instable.
The challenge for us as Christians is how can we be salt and light?
Donc notre défi en tant que chrétiens, c'est comment nous pouvons être sel et lumière.
And in particular, can we demonstrate, not just to speak about it, but to demonstrate this other view of humanity?
Il est important non seulement d'en parler, mais de manifester, de démontrer cet autre point de vue sur l'humanité.
Je vais dire ma question en français, après, en anglais, et après je la traduirai en français. So, I was interested in what you were saying about, you know, the beginning of life and also the distinction between restorative and enhancing medicine. But sometimes, as you say, it's not very clear cut. And personally, my husband and I, we had a long, very long journey to have a child. And as such, we know quite well the community of around infertility, and including Christian missionaries even who are confronted with it. And I find it very difficult, and I'd like to hear what you think, to know in your perception, like, where is that frontier? Because, for instance, you know, I have, there are several cases where without IVF, there's no hope of conception. I also have a friend who's a Christian missionary who, for instance, her cells were killing all, so she had 6 consecutive miscarriages because her cells sort of identify that this was something to get rid of. And, you know, when you get married in the Christian church, it's also with the hope of raising children, of sharing God's love with other beings. So it feels like it's something that can be justified to use medicine, including IVF, for that purpose. So I'll just translate before.
Sure.
Je posais la question. Je disais que j'étais intéressée sur en gros, la distinction qui a été faite entre d'un côté que c'était acceptable d'utiliser la médecine pour on va dire des visées restauratives, mais pas pour quand c'était pour augmenter les capacités de l'être humain. Et je demandais en particulier autour du début de la vie et sur la question de l'infertilité, comment ça pouvait se traduire. Parce que, bon, personnellement, c'est quelque chose avec laquelle j'ai été confrontée pendant des années, donc je connais très bien la communauté, y compris chrétienne, autour de l'infertilité. Et je disais, il y a quand même plusieurs, enfin, beaucoup de cas où enfin, voilà, des couples qui ne peuvent concevoir que à travers la FIV, ou alors, je disais aussi, j'ai une amie qui elle-même était missionnaire protestante, qui a eu 6 fausses couches de suite et qui pouvait simplement, enfin, qui a eu besoin en fait d'un traitement pour neutraliser son propre, ses propres agents, afin qu'ils arrêtent de tuer, enfin, l'embryon. Et finalement, elle a pu avoir un enfant comme ça. Et donc, je voulais demander un peu comment est-ce que ça s'articule dans cette, enfin, pour le professeur. Où est-ce qu'on voit la frontière entre restauratif et enhancing? Parce qu'en même temps, c'est vrai qu'avec le mariage chrétien, c'est quand même un but d'avoir des enfants au-delà du consumérisme et de partager l'amour de Dieu avec des plus petits que soi.
Yes, the first thing to say is I understand the pain of infertility is a very real pain.
Tout d'abord, j'ai dit que la douleur de l'infertilité est une véritable douleur, souffrance.
Often the Christian church is very insensitive towards infertile people.
Et dans l'église, on peut manquer de sensibilité, de compassion envers ces personnes.
My understanding in biblical theology is that making babies and making love belong together.
Dans la théologie chrétienne, on peut pas séparer faire un bébé et faire l'amour.
It's not an accident that the most profound way we have as human beings of expressing physical love for someone else is also the way that a baby is made.
Ce n'est pas un accident en quelque sorte que la façon humaine dont nous disposons pour montrer son amour envers quelqu'un est aussi la manière de faire un bébé.
In fact, the baby is a physical incarnation of the invisible love between a man and a woman.
Le bébé est comme une incarnation physique de l'amour invisible entre un homme et une femme.
So if you take this understanding and apply it to IVF,
donc si on transfère cette idée vers la FIV,
it seems to me that when you have a man and a woman who are married, who are in covenant commitment to one another,
quand il y a un homme et une femme mariés qui vivent avec un engagement mutuel l'un envers l'autre.
And you take the sperm from the husband and the egg from the wife and you combine them in the laboratory.
Et vous prenez le spermatozoïde de l'homme et l'ovule de la femme et on les met ensemble en laboratoire.
And you put the embryo back in the womb of the wife.
On remet l'embryon dans l'utérus de l'épouse.
So she is able to bring to birth the incarnation of their love.
Pour qu'elle puisse accoucher de l'incarnation de leur amour.
Then that seems to me an example of restorative therapy.
Pour moi, c'est une thérapie restaurative.
There are still many difficulties and questions about the embryo research and about the money that is, and the technology.
Il reste encore des questions hein, concernant la recherche au sujet des embryons, au sujet des finances nécessaires pour de telles interventions.
But at heart, it seems to me you can regard it as restoration.
Mais au fond, au cœur, on peut penser que c'est une thérapie restaurative.
But to take an egg from here and a sperm from there and to put it in the womb of another person.
Et prendre une ovule par là, un spermatozoïde ailleurs, de l'implanter dans l'utérus d'une tierce personne.
This is to break the link between making love and making babies.
On casse ce lien entre faire l'amour et faire un bébé.
So, it seems to me, it's less to do with the technology and it's more to do with the goal of the technology.
Donc, ce n'est pas tellement question de technologie, mais de la finalité de la technologie.
Merci.
Dernière question.
C'est pour continuer sur ce débat-là, en fait, effectivement, sur la limite entre la thérapie, enfin, tout ce qui est restauratif et ce qui est, je ne sais plus le terme, qui a grandi, en fait, les capacités de l'homme. Just to stay on, to focus on this debate between, about the limits between a therapy which restores and a therapy which enlarges the human. I don't understand how you can say on one part, yes, this is good to have one man and one woman bound by love and using technology to restore a body which is not working anymore, and how you can condemn, on which basis you condemn, like, two men who are bound by love and maybe who have a commitment, something like that. How can we condemn in front of the society? On which basis can we say one is good and one is not good? It feels like we are taking what is good for us in technology and condemning what is what could be good for other people. I may be the advocate of devil.
Yes, yes, I understand.
It's
understand.
An argument I hear a lot. Donc je traduis ma question. En fait, c'était comment est-ce qu'on peut dire d'un côté, oui, c'est bien d'avoir d'utiliser la technologie pour un homme et une femme qui sont mariés, qui s'aiment, pour réparer ce que le corps peut plus faire. En même temps, condamner en fait d'un autre côté deux hommes en fait qui sont aussi peut-être qui s'aiment, qui ont un engagement que la société civile permet, et leur dire que là, c'est un péché. Je pense qu'il y a une base à développer pour, en termes de discours en fait devant la société.
I understand. The difficulty and the challenge.
Bon, je comprends bien la difficulté, le défi que cela nous pose.
But the issue of identity is very central to this.
Mais la question de l'identité est centrale dans ce débat.
There have been some interesting studies of adults who were born through reproductive technology.
Bon, on a fait des études sur les adultes qui sont nés à partir de ces moyens reproductifs.
Particularly those who are born following sperm or egg donation.
Surtout auprès de ceux qui sont nés à partir de donateurs de spermatozoïdes ou d'ovules.
And the overriding impression is one of deep questioning about identity.
Et on se rend compte que ces personnes-là ont un questionnement profond par rapport à leur identité.
In fact, the title of one book with these stories is called Who Am I?
Le titre d'ailleurs d'un livre écrit à ce sujet, c'est tout simplement Qui suis-je?
Often these children only discover about their genetic identity later in life.
Ces enfants découvrent leur identité génétique plus tard dans la vie que au moment de leur enfance.
Sometimes they discover they have 50 half siblings all conceived with the same donor.
Et parfois ils découvrent par exemple qu'ils ont 50 demi-frères ou demi-sœurs à partir du même donateur.
And they must somehow come to terms with understanding their own genesis.
Et puis quelque part il faut qu'ils acceptent cette problématique de leur propre naissance.
And many of them say the people who underwent the technology were being selfish.
Et souvent, ces personnes interrogées disent les personnes qui ont accepté cette technologie ont été en fait égoïstes.
They were only thinking about their own needs.
Ils pensaient seulement à leurs propres besoins.
They never considered what the implications might be for the child themselves.
Ils n'ont jamais tenu compte des implications en ce qui concerne l'enfant lui-même.
And so paradoxically they say, I am very glad to be alive.
Alors, paradoxalement, ils disent, je suis très content d'être en vie.
But I wish it wasn't by this way.
Mais j'aurais voulu que ce soit pas par ce moyen.
So I think we must understand the pain of people who are infertile.
Donc il faut comprendre la souffrance des personnes infertiles.
And that means we must be very sympathetic to, you know, gay partners who long to have a child.
Donc on peut avoir, oui, même de la compassion pour un couple d'homosexuels, par exemple, qui désirent un enfant.
But I think there are strong empirical reasons as well as theological reasons to say there should be limits to how the technology is used.
Mais je pense qu'il y a des raisons non seulement théologiques mais empiriques, pragmatiques par rapport à l'utilisation de cette technologie.
In my book Matters of Life and Death there is a whole chapter on this issue which with more references and information.
Donc il y a tout un chapitre dans le livre Questions de vie et de mort disponible au fond de la salle qui répond à cette question.
Thanks very much. Thank you.